This is Fix It. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Nishant. Today, we're fixing reductionism and freedom of thought with Sinead O'Sullivan.
Those are some big words and ideas, but don't worry, fixers. Sinead is going to break them down for us. Sinead is an aerospace engineer from Ireland with ties to some of the best schools around the world, including the Harvard Business School, Queen's University of Belfast, which has a beautiful campus if you haven't checked it out, the Georgia Institute of Technology, and the International Space University.
You might call her a space expert, actually. She's conducted and led research for the Space Generation Advisory Council, Georgia Tech, and the U.S. Center for Climate and Security, not to mention the European Space Agency and NASA.
So you may be asking, what the heck is a space expert doing talking about reductionism and freedom of thought? Well, we'll dive into that, but it's important to point out Sinead's engineering background and her ability to analyze and study complex systems. She's currently at MIT, heading up research into the Democracy and Freedom of Thought Project for the AI Policy for the World Project. Welcome to the show, Sinead.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start off by just telling us more about reductionism, what it is, and how it relates to freedom of thought?
Sure. I'm going to try to explain this by using some reductionism myself. So basically, reductionism is the practice of analyzing and describing complex phenomena in terms of kind of the more simple or fundamental constituents. So if you think about, for example, a lot of this comes from the study of biology or kind of the physical phenomena. When you break something down, for example, you break down an animal into its limbs or its organs, you break the organs down into its constituent parts, and then you basically keep reducing it down into something like a gene or genetics or a DNA code. And the process of breaking down these ideas or the system into its constituents is the process of reductionism itself. Now, we see that in basic science research. We're also starting to see that in some of the things that I'm researching at the minute, such as social sciences or politics or business.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how and why there have been barriers to solving reductionism in the status quo? What's making this so tricky to get out of our heads?
Well, I guess before I talk about how to fix it, I think I'm going to talk briefly about why it's a problem. So it's great that we understand more about DNA, and we wouldn't, you know, we absolutely wouldn't have been able to do that without this process of reductionism. So reductionism is actually important, and it plays a huge role in kind of the conceptualization and the development of theory, analyzing certain problems. In fields, again, such as, you know, physics, biology, chemistry. The issue with reductionism, however, is that it doesn't allow you to really understand something like complexity or complexity science. And so, you know, what is complexity or complex systems? It's really when you get a lot of these kind of subsystems together and they have second or third order impacts that, you know, have kind of emergent behavior. And so if you study or analyze something in this kind of reductionist capacity, it doesn't allow you to understand or analyze or even be able to model a complex problem in a way such that you understand why these interactions are having the second or third order effects. And often what we're starting to see in social sciences, in economics, is that it's these second or third or fourth or fifth interaction effects that are the problems that we're trying to solve for. And then you kind of have this gap in the middle. You know, we are increasingly as a society thinking along in terms of reductionism, yet the problems that we're trying to solve are more of the complex nature. And those kind of problems, the kind of the big, you know, societal grand challenges could be anything from globalization to poverty. When we look at climate change, it's definitely a complex problem. And the one that we're probably most familiar with at the minute is coronavirus. You know, when you start to think about the interactions, the second and third order interactions that I mentioned, you know, these are kind of the non-linear problems that are associated with flattening the curve, for example. So it's not like the common flu or the common colds every winter. You know, the reason why COVID is so dangerous, particularly for our globalized world, is because all of these problems are connected so tightly that even a small perturbation changes the interactions and the effects, meaning that we don't really know what we're solving for or how to solve for it anymore.
So to get back to this idea or this analogy to DNA, can we kind of think of it as if someone were to go in and mess up with your DNA and say, oh, I'm going to solve this at the level of a single gene or a single piece of DNA, not being able to anticipate how that's going to disrupt so many other things about the body. So you may be really proud of your work to take on a single issue and say, oh, I've solved it, I've looked at this single strand, but then not being able to understand how it fits within the larger system. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah. So when you look at, medical trials, you know, there's a lot of complex modeling used there, because when you look at the interaction of a drug and the effect, the kind of cause and effect at a cellular level, they exhibit very different outcomes when presented with real world interactions. So for example, when you change the diet, and this is why they, you know, they test drugs every few years, you change the input to the system, some of the constituent system parts change over time. Our bodies change as we get older. You know, there are in-group differences between, you know, gender, race. And so all of these kind of inputs to the system make it more complex. It's a really great way to think about how we're using artificial intelligence and technology. So for example, when we use AI, a lot of the time we're doing regressions and we don't understand why we get an outcome, but we know that there's a cause and effect, and most of the time that this effect can be explained by one or two inputs. Over time, with complex systems, AI is actually a little bit concerning when you think about the fact that we understand less and less of the underlying components, and actually we're not even modeling the complex system at all. So we have multiple failure modes and a highly connected system, and we don't really understand the reasons why the system is working, or, you know, the kind of emergent behavior that we're seeing from it.
So Sinead, I think that's a great overview of what reductionism is and how it infiltrates so many aspects of multiple different fields, including policymaking or DNA analysis. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, how you're thinking about changes that we can all make to fix reductionism and the shortcomings that it has, especially when it comes to our inability to think about these third, fourth, fifth order effects that complex problems incur?
Yeah. So, you know, you spoke a little bit about my background at the beginning of this, and I think this is kind of where that becomes more useful. So a lot of the work that I did at NASA and JPL and other cool space places and technology places allowed me to do a lot of robust modeling of complex systems to do kind of future concept designs. And what we were really trying to do there at NASA is predict to some extent, or to better understand the interaction of technologies that we wanted to incorporate but weren't actually existing today, and we couldn't really test their outcomes yet. What has become quite clear in the, you know, in the previous years, and I think, you know, probably people outside of the complexity science field will notice, is that our institutions are becoming increasingly fragmented. And the problems that we all face, you know, COVID being a number one example of this, are becoming increasingly complex. And so there's this general divide or gap between how we think about these problems and how we solve for them, and what our institutions, whether it's academic or government or kind of business, how they're modeled or how they kind of present themselves today. And there's a gap there in that, you know, our stakeholders aren't connected well enough to be able to solve for them. And, you know, even looking at the business level, you've got divisions and subdivisions that are pretty siloed and just don't make for solving these kinds of problems. And, you know, getting back to some of the work at MIT that I'm doing, we can see this playing out at a much more societal level when we consider something like freedom of thought and how our thoughts are impacted by technology and this kind of polarization. And what we're seeing, you know, with polarization, you know, for example, I think it's fascinating to look at the kind of cancel culture that, you know, that people are talking about at the minute. And cancel culture, what that really represents for me from a systems or a complex systems perspective is the inability to understand second or third effects of concepts that our society are trying to deal with that are complex. You know, I think we're seeing movement on the left and the right politically to go in one direction. So, you know, on one side, you've got let's burn the system down and start from scratch. And on the other side, you've got, well, let's just never let the system change and try and, you know, even go back to a different era and the system that, you know, the political institution that existed back then. And the reality is that our society is somewhere in between, in this kind of turbulent, messy, complex flow in the middle, where it's possible and even desirable that people should be able to hold more than one conflicting thought at a time. And the issue, you know, kind of linking this back to technology, is that all of the ways that we engage with each other, whether it's online, the media that we consume, kind of take away this freedom of thought from us by, you know, having us interact in 160 character tweets or in short form text messages or with emojis or with sound bites, because, you know, in a day we might consume more than 5,000 commercials or 5,000 brands that are trying to get our attention. So how do we kind of counter some of that and allow ourselves the time and the energy to think about the complexity that, you know, even in the dialogue that's happening in our kind of civic space?
And I think this is such an important and timely topic with an election coming up, with a pandemic going on, and with this continuation of cancel culture, and thinking about your own media consumption hygiene, I guess, because when you think about all of these layers being stacked toward reductionism, it gets a little scary, right? I get on to some newsletter. That newsletter has already been curated to someone exactly like me or someone near, you know, modeled off of me. The headlines are just a few words that are going to scream out things like Trump or Democrat, Republican, or Mitch McConnell is a turtle or something like that. And then the article itself is also not going to dive into a terribly complex analysis of the issue. And so all of these things get toward that kind of reduction of freedom of thought where you were expressing, where our day-to-day lives are run between the kind of bowler alley or bowling lane bumpers of whatever systems we're engaged in, and our thoughts are kind of forced to go within that scope. That was a really long ramble, but it got us to where we needed to go, which is, for the folks listening today, what steps would you recommend they take, whether it's as an agent within a larger system that they can help reduce reductionism wherever they are in their company or perhaps in their level of government, or perhaps offer some kind of day-to-day insights that you take to reduce the influence of reductionism in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think reductionism and kind of, as you mentioned, polarization are, you know, I wouldn't say they go directly hand in hand, but one is a consequence of the other. And I do think what, you know, my research looking at democracy and technology, and reductionism absolutely contributes to a lack of democracy, because, you know, democracy relies on an informed group of people, and the ability to stay informed is actually much harder than it seems, because it's not just consuming news. It's being really thoughtful about the type of news that you're consuming. And it really puts the onus back on the individual. And, you know, when I think about how can I become more informed, or how can I reduce my own personal life, this reductionism, it really requires the individual to take responsibility and to live in that center ground where I can, again, look at two conflicting thoughts and try to hold them at the same time. It means that I have to engage with some things that I don't necessarily feel comfortable with, but that kind of discomfort in the middle is the ability to see something from both sides and really being, you know, trying to better understand the world that we live in and trying to better understand the big picture and to understand why somebody might be coming and saying something that I vehemently disagree with. Are there second or third order impacts that they are optimizing for in their ideology or thought that I'm not considering right now? And what are the kind of bigger or the longer term impacts of my thoughts or my beliefs about something? And trying to even model my own thinking as a complex system. And it's okay to get it wrong. You know, it's complex. And the world around us is really complex and messy. And I think if nothing else, understanding that it's okay to be complex and messy. I think we want, you know, Nishant, sorry, I know you're a venture capitalist. I think a lot of venture capital and technology thrives on this ideal of us having these really simple, easy lives. And to a certain degree, I don't think that's helpful. I think that our lives are messy and complex, and so are the solutions that we're going to have for some of these problems. And I think not being so scared of complexity and kind of being more comfortable in it. And if that just means reading something that, you know, is longer form, maybe less headlines and longer form articles and essays from people who think more deeply about these things is one way to start becoming less reductionist in our daily lives.
Well, Sinead, I think that wraps it up pretty nicely for our listeners. Hopefully, come election season especially, but beyond that, when considering any complex problems, our listeners will make more of an effort to dig deeper into things beyond the immediate symptom, to get into what the second and third order effects might be of a particular policy, technology, or action. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Fixers, for tuning in. Please use hashtag Fixer on Twitter to tell us about the problems you're solving. And you can tweet @fix_cast. Be sure to spread the word, and we look forward to seeing you next time.